Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey everyone, Dr. Jason Old here, surfer, historian, world traveler, and your host of the Surfing Historian Podcast. This season, we'll be diving deeper into the nuanced world of surfing and examining the historical, cultural, philosophical, and even scientific elements of the sport we're all stoked on. So let's paddle out together and ride through the world of academia. This episode is sponsored by Banana Bag Oral Solution. These are definitely not your typical dehydration supplement. In fact, they're my personal go-to after a long surf session when I'm looking to avoid exhaustion and dehydration. Check them out at bananabag.org and use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. You'll also get free shipping if you join their mailing list. Joining me today from Goleta, California is Dr. Tim Cooley. Tim's an ethnomusicology professor in the Department of Music at the University of California in Santa Barbara. His research interests center around popular and vernacular music of Central Europe, notably Poland, and North America, paying particular attention to the roles of musicking in creating individual and community identities. His current research interest is in learning what music studies might teach us about how we engage with the ecosystems that support all life, what he calls ecomusicology. This includes surfing, especially in Hawaii, where there's a long history of chants and dances pulling together surfing, courtship, and living in complex ecosystems where land and oceans meet. He argues that surfing itself remains fundamentally the same, but the context for surfing keeps shifting. In some ways, however, the meaning of surfing changes, and this may also require musical changes too. For today's episode, we'll be talking about his book, Surfing About Music, published in 2014, and how musicking about surfing changed as cultural ideas about surfing itself changed. I'm super stoked to have you on to share your music knowledge and insight with our listeners. But before we get started, I want to personally thank you, Tim, as well as our listeners, for being part of this episode of The Surfing Historian.
Thanks, Jason. It's really a privilege and honor to be invited to talk about music and surfing, or what I would rather say, musicking and surfing. I can explain why I like the verbal form of music at length, if you like.
Tim, no, you know, the pleasure is mine for sure. You know, I've been kind of hunting down someone to be able to talk about music, or as you call it, musicking, which, you know, I use that word in the intro, of course. But yeah, I think many of us would like to know what that word even means. But it was really awesome to come across your work, and I'm, you know, again, very grateful you've come on the show. And let's get on into it. You know, your book, Surfing About Music, is, you know, one, I really enjoy it. And again, I'm biased because I'm just a huge music fan. But maybe for our listeners, let's start out with something simple, like, you know, what compelled you to write about music, or write about this particular, let's say, genre of music?
This question of identity intrigued me about, you know, how do they create community? And there's this thing called surf music, which I associated with Dick Dale and the Beach Boys, his albums I had. And, you know, when I listened to Back East, and, you know, that's how one of the ways I learned about Southern California surf culture is through this music. But it didn't quite work in the late 90s and early 2000s here. You're right. So that's what compelled me to do this book. I also want to give a shout out to Terry Keller, who was an undergraduate in one of my classes at the time. And he came in with a project for the class on a band called the Merman, which is a San Francisco-based instrumental rock band, a surf band of that genre that was really named in the very early 1960s around a couple of bands, including especially the Bel Airs and Dick Dale. And, we can get more into that. So
absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I don't even know where to start, you know, with there's so much music I want to talk about. And, but, you know, I do want to kind of, you know, add to what you were saying. You know, I'm just envisioning you surfing in Santa Barbara at this point and thinking like, this is my life. This is where I'm being paid to live and surf right here. And I think, you know, that's part of the beauty of, at least for me, what we do as, you know, let's say surf scholars, you know, because my research centers around, you know, Popoya Reef in Nicaragua. And the first time I surfed that, you know, the best way I was described it to my friends, and this is long before even considering that I would write my dissertation about this place, but, you know, it was this place where as a kid, and I'm sure you did the same thing, you know, when you would draw in your notebooks, what a perfect wave would look like, you know, the perfect day. And I'm sitting out in that water and, you know, the water's warm, it's offshore, it's 6 to 8 foot, you know, A-frame break. And, you know, I was like, this is what I drew as a kid. And so it's kind of like what you were saying about, you know, surfing that point in Santa Barbara. And, but yeah, I you know, I don't want to get too distracted on Nicaragua, but I will throw, you know, before you tell us what an ethnomusicologist is, I will say this, you know, with regards to Nicaragua and music, there was a band called Sacred Rite, which you've probably heard, you know, thrash metal band of the 80s. And they wrote a song called Surf Nicaragua. And I discovered them in my research. But again, like I said, I don't want to you know, steal your thunder. I want to talk specifically about this book. But before we get into the specifics of the book, could you please share with the listeners and myself, what is an ethnomusicologist?
Yeah, it's like what is a surfer, right? And by the way, before we go any further, you have to promise to send me that recording.
Oh, absolutely. The Sacred Rite song?
Yeah, because I do not know it. And, right. Well, this awkward word ethnomusicology emerged in the 1950s by a bunch of music-interested anthropologists, really. So the ethno means people. You know, we're all ethnos. We all have ethnicity, even though sometimes we attribute it to others, but we all have ethnicity. So my favorite kind of simple definition is the study of people making music. So it puts, you know, people back into the sometimes objectified thing we call music. In the 1960s, there was a really influential ethnomusicologist, and he took that name, and his name was Alan Merriam, and he came up with a really interesting three-part model that, which is that music has to be considered a concept, a behavior, and a sound. So it doesn't start with sound; it starts with concept, right? You know, what do you think is music? What are the edges of music where it's no longer music and it's, you know, something else? What is your idea for what how are you going to create a piece of music? That's all concept. And then there's behavior. That's what you do. You know, when you're playing your guitar, you have an idea and you're turning it into behavior, right? Or singing a song. And the third part of that was sound. You know, that makes sound, and they all influence each other. You know, the sound influences your behavior, makes you want to dance or makes you want to practice more. You know, there's in any number of ways the sound and the behavior influences this whole concept of music itself, which is constantly changed. That, you know, that's kind of an interesting model of a way of breaking music or moving music around beyond just a sound phenomenon. And then there's a more recently, not so recently, but there's a guy named Christopher Small who wrote a book called Musicking. And his argument was that we need to stop talking about music as an object. We need to talk about it as an activity. You know, objectifying music commodifies it. It privileges certain types of music. You know, it's really brilliant and influential book. Just a brilliant. He was a jazz person. He was a music educator. And he's just a wonderfully profound book, Musicking. And he went as far as to say, well, Musicking involves everything and everything around music, even the person setting up the chairs for a rehearsal, or, you know, that's part of the Musicking. You can't, you know, the person who makes the instrument is Musicking, because you can't make the sound on an instrument without the person who makes the instrument. And so you went that far, which I think is really interesting. And it's, you know, the main object was, it's an activity. You have to do music. You can't, it doesn't exist unless you do it. And that also resonated with surfing with me. Now, surfing is a concept. You know, we think about surfing, we dream about surfing, we draw in our, when we're in middle school, you know, I did that. You know, I have so many drawings of these feathering waves, right? We draw and we, you know, we have these ideas and these concepts, but to actually, and that's part of surfing, right? That's part of how you learn how to be a surfer is to imagine and identify ideal conditions. But then that's part of the doing it is, you know, riding the wave is really just part of it. So these are the things that, yeah. And another scholar that influenced me, his name is Catherine Hagedorn. He used to be down the street at Pomona College. She said that music is one of the way that you better understand, you better understand what is deeply effective for people, what is meaningful for people. And if you, and you have to dedicate yourself to kind of living with and those people. So that's, you know, that's part of how I'd like to kind of define ethnomusicology. There are other definitions.
Yeah, certainly. But, you know, that's that, you know, I stumbled upon this word a while back, you know, working with a student of mine on his master's thesis who, you know, loved music, loved history, political science. And we, you know, I came across this word ethnomusicology, and I'm like, hey man, there's a field that you can, you know, kind of participate in or contribute to by bringing together all the things you really love to study. And so that was my first exposure to it. And I, you know, I think it's, you know, again, the scholars you mentioned, your work is, you know, in my limited view, let's say, is a really good example of that. And so, you know, thanks for sharing that definition or your definition with the listeners. You use the word musicking, and I don't know if, you know, you necessarily defined it specifically, but how would you define musicking? Because I know, you know, I mentioned it in the intro, and it's something that a word you've been using, but is there like a real succinct way you would define the actual word musicking?
Well, yeah, I think it de-objectifies it. So it's turning into a verb. So musicking is something you do. And another part that became important in my book is musicking is one of the ways societies kind of perform ideals about the best way to be a society. So this is, again, from Christopher Small. He's like, one of the things we do with music is we model ideal societies. So it's kind of takes music away from the idea of it as an object, as a recording, a track, and makes it something that we need to participate in and with to be truly meaningful. And that so worked that, pretty well with surfing.
Yeah. And so that was kind of my question. I do want to get into the book here in just a second, but you know, when you use the word participate in, that's including sort of the audience, if you will. You know, so me, you know, the other day, of course, this is being recorded at a different time when it'll be released. But, you know, I had just recently seen The Cure, which is, you know, a favorite band of mine. And, you know, I participated in a sense in that experience. So that's kind of how you would define musicking, or am I misunderstanding that?
Yeah, totally. By being there at the experience and enjoying the music, you were musicking.
It's enlightening for me and very encouraging, since I can't sing and can't play a single instrument. So to know that I can participate in, you know, as you call it, musicking, that's, you know, reassuring. But I do,
go ahead. I'm going to interrupt you here because that's so rich. What you said, one of the kind of core beliefs of ethnomusicology is that to be human is to be musical, and that all humans are musical, and that if one is, but there are societies that have, that emphasize specializations, and one of them is music. And so music, especially in an institutional sense, is defined in particular ways. And if you can't do music in that way, say like Western art music, for example, if you don't play that way, then it's not music in your, and so we're trained to, some societies train a majority of the population to believe that they are not musical, which the ethnomusicology flips that and says, no, all humans are musical. And, you know, we require audiences and to absorb, listen to, and move to appreciate music. That is being musical. That is musicking. And of course the performers need that as much as they need, you know, you need them. I officially say you are a musician or you are musical, Jason. Okay. So that's
okay. You've bestowed that on me. I appreciate that.
The authority bestowed on me by the University of California.
I appreciate that, you know, and it's so you talking about musicking in that sense really makes it more of a, I would go as far as to say, this symbiotic relationship between artist and audience. And, you know, that's beautiful. And I like that you made that point. And so let's talk about artists and surfers and get into this book. And, you know, you just sort of out of the gates, you say, you know, if this book is about anything, it's about the intersections of music and surfing before and since surf music. So, you know, myself, as I was reading that, and the listeners are probably like, well, what is before and since surf music? So what do you mean when you say since surf music? Is it not all surf music?
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts, so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
I love that question. Thank you so much for that question. It may be, I can tell you what I meant, but I also am aware that what I meant may have been a period of time that I lived through, and so it was part of my understanding surfing and musicking. So it's surf music, and in my book I specify, when I say surf capital S and music capital S, I'm referring to two very specific and related genres that came about, that were first named in 1961 or 62. So Surfing by the Beach Boys, Let's Go Trippin' by Dick Dale, and there was a piece by the Bel Airs, which I'm forgetting, it might have been Mr. Moto even, that were called surf music by DJs in the LA area. So these are all LA area, South LA area bands.
So really, sorry to interject there. So you're really calling that specific era, if you will, or what, you know, DJs were calling it, surf music. So that specific snapshot of music and time is really what you mean by surf music. Am I understanding that?
Yeah, I am. And it's not, but the era extends. I mean, there are still bands that call themselves surf bands. There are still surf music festivals in Southern California, but you know, I had a lot of fun finding one in Italy, on the West Coast there, that was in a little place, wasn't even a village, called California. It's the name of this place down below a large city called Livorno. Since then, the festival has moved up to Livorno, where there is a a cafe called Surfer Joe Cafe, which is founded by the same kind of guy who does the surf festival. And it's you know, it's primarily instrumental rock. That has a certain sound that came to be known as surf music, even though some of it existed before anything was called surf music, especially the Ventures. They were recording things, you know, Walk Don't Run, for example, in the 50s, before anything was called surf music, but it became called surf music. In fact, they did a whole series of LPs called Learn to Play Surf Music. They're wonderful. You can get them on CD now. And they do each part slow, and then they do it at speed, like the bass part slow and speed, and the lead guitar and the rhythm guitar. I highly recommend it to you if you want to. All you surf guitarists or guitars, you want to learn that. They're brilliant.
Well, yeah, it's.
I'll send you mine. You know, I don't need them anymore.
Yeah, no worries. I love that music. I love the style, and I'm glad that you were, you know, sort of specified that it's a sound. It's a particular sound, more than it is that specific, those specific years, because as people replicate that sound even into the more modern, let's say more modern, you know, 21st century, let's say, like that still falls under that umbrella, if you will, of surf music. Is that what you were trying to say?
Yeah. And you know, it's a phenomenon. In some ways, you might see the name surf music as a bit of a historical accident that's attached to the sound of music, which existed before, and in so many ways it existed before. But it's there. And the reason I felt like I had to deal with that as a genre is because, at least in my own mind and with some people I interacted with this research, surf music meant that. And surfers from that era didn't want to talk about that. If they were a certain age, this is one of the findings of my kind of oral research interviewing surfers here, primarily here in Southern California. So if they were 20 or something in 1960, they often did not want to talk about surf music. They wouldn't mind talking about music that they associate with surfing, but they didn't want to talk about the genre. They meant the genre surf music, yeah, which I put as, you know, capital S and capital M in the book to kind of try, yeah, to make it a bit clearer. But if you're 12 in 1960, that was your music and you associated it. So, you know, I met both, and they're both really valid responses, yeah, to it. But it also very much relates to kind of branding, right? And so this music was branded surf music in 61 or 62 by DJs. The Beach Boys specifically wrote surfing about surfing. You know, they were noticing this culture at Hawthorne High School where they were, and there was the, you know, the Greasers, and then there's this other group called the Surfers. And so they were singing about that. So that's pretty interesting. But in my book, you know, similar to your really nice work with Nicaragua, I say, well, this is part of kind of American commercialization of surfing. Hawaii had become the 50th state in 1959. So, you know, 2 years later, there's something called surf music, and it's centered in Southern California, not Hawaii. There was music. There's centuries of music about surfing in Hawaii before this time, but that wasn't, maybe you could write, say it's referenced in some of the whammy bar might, you know, have, there were certain sounds that might be called Hawaiian, but there's problems with that too. But you see what I'm saying? That this marked,
yeah, absolutely,
cultural moment when, yeah, surfing was being associated with Southern California. Is that, for some surfers, that was part of their experience. For the others, it was a problem. They didn't, you know, they didn't associate that music with it. And, so that's why I felt like I had to, visually I see it as a bottleneck for what music is associated with surfing. It got narrowed down to this vocal songs about surfing and instrumental rock. And then after that, it expanded. And before that, it was a much broader idea of what was associated with surfing. But that, I felt like it got a bottleneck there. And I had to make sure people knew I was writing beyond that genre.
Yeah.
And that era.
No, exactly. No, and I really appreciate you breaking that apart, because in something I've always, and again, just, you know, just to put it out there, I've always enjoyed the Beach Boys. I love their music. And I did, you know, I wasn't around when they were, you know, I wasn't born when they were making music in the 60s, but, you know, I always, something I found, you know, somewhat ironic is that I think only one of them surfed. And to my knowledge, a lot of the more, and I don't know if this is to your point, but a lot of the more, let's say, hardcore, serious surfers of that time considered them to be kooks. And so, but yeah, you raise a great point about the musical tradition of Hawaii. And I do want to dig into that a little bit, because I think even when Duke Kahanamoku, he might have been in Australia or New Zealand. I think Matt Warshaw talks about this in the history of surfing, but you know, they wanted Duke to give this speech. And what did he do? He just broke out his ukulele and started playing, you know, Hawaiian music. And so, you know, there really is this tradition, this intimate tradition and culture of the ocean and music, particularly in Hawaii. And I, you know, if you wouldn't mind, I'd like to dig into that a little bit, and then we can get back to the Beach Boys and sort of the, how surf music became, surfing and surf music was essentially appropriated by, you know, people of Southern California. So, but yeah, what are some of the connections that Hawaiian traditionally, that connection they had with music in the ocean, or musicking and the ocean, to use your word?
Historically?
Yeah, just historically, in terms of, you know, even how did it, was there a tradition of, let's say, you know, music and surfing that predates, let's say, what we were calling the surf music genre, but in Hawaii? I don't know if that question made sense.
That makes a lot of sense. And there definitely was and is a tradition of musicking associated with surfing in very specific ways. You know, I know the most about the surfing associated with the royal classes, or the chief classes in Hawaii, because, like in so many societies, that's the histories that tend to be recorded. That's a problem with the way we record histories. But one of the things I learned was that there were surfing chants for especially royal surfers. You know, King Kamehameha had a surfing chant. King Kalakahua had a surfing chant that was sang his praises of his surfing ability, and the queens also had similar chants. So I analyze a number of those, and a lot of the knowledge comes in that is in the language, and I was able to get some two different chanters do versions of those for record sound versions of those chanted, one sort of a declaration style and some in a more more sung style. My understanding is a sung style. So, and these are also related to movement. So visible poetry or a hula dance, which would have, you know, specific movements that related to the language, and this is part of the performance, and it would be performed at surfing contests, which existed, you know, back hundreds of years. And so, you know, this link to royalty, even though royalty weren't the only ones that surfed, they had certain surfing privileges, but they, you know, everyone was in the water, everyone surfed, poor and rich, and male and female. Some of the queens were sung as the being the best surfers of anyone, better than the men. So, you know, it's really quite a deep and integrated example of musicking and surfing as blending in with each other, and structures of society being represented in these. And the modern 19th century post-contact mailers that include surfing also reference other parts, other kingdoms in the world. France and Russia are referenced in some of the surfing chants, and they talk about surfing is done this way in France and in Russia, and so it's integrating surfing as a way of being, you know, and in very nice ways. And they also name places around Hawaii which tended to be kind of hot surf spots. So it's deeply ingrained with the idea of culture and power and community, and courtship. You know, that this is all part of what surfing was. You know, it wasn't a sport that was separate. It's something that you did when you had free time, right?
Yeah, it was, you know, not only you and a number of other scholars that write on Hawaii, you know, talk about this link. Like you said, it wasn't, you know, quote unquote, just a sport. It was inextricably linked to culture, intimately linked to culture. And, you know, it's, you know, I'm really glad you know, not only to have you on just to talk about music, but to really take that direction and help us understand the role music played in this culture and how it was tied to surfing. And, one of the things that I wanted to ask you, though, is, you know, so as we move into the 20th century, let's say early 1900s, when George Freeth, you know, comes to California, he's surfing and really, I would say, helps in the popularization of surfing in, you know, California, Southern Malibu and elsewhere, of course. But have you looked at why, right? Because surfing becomes popular, but the music of the Hawaiians, this music that you were just talking about, doesn't catch on. Was Freeth just not playing music, or why did surfing catch on and not the music attached to surfing? That's what I'm trying to ask.
That's a really great question and a complicated one. Just like in Nicaragua, surfing was in Hawaii, Scott Latterman covers this so well in his Empire of Surf book. The surfing was seen as a way to attract white investment in Hawaii, white people's investment in Hawaii. And Scott and others have been very careful to identify the racist motives of people like Alexander Hume Ford. Freeth is an interesting one as a Hapa'ali himself. You know, he is at least half Hawaiian and the other half from the British Isles, either Irish or English. You know, that's disputed where his, you know, I was ready to have him as be Irish. But I think Patrick Moser is questioning that in his wonderful book, Search and Rescue.
I had Patrick on. Great book and great conversation on George Freeth, for sure.
Yeah, such a wonderful read. So yeah, Freeth, I'm not, you know, that's a really complicated, very specific example. Each of these examples are specific, but some of them are pretty clear what was going on. So in in 1903, there's a new style of music called Hapa'ali music, and so half Hawaiian, and this was often ukulele based. Ukulele was an instrument introduced really on maybe a decade before to Hawaii, but it's become associated with and developed in a certain way that is now Hawaiian. So this became popular music in Hawaii, but also in the United States. I mean, Hapa'ali music was the best seller for decades up through the 50s. So in the 20s, when records, you could buy a recorded sound, which really started, was available in the 19th century, but became something that many homes would have in the teens. Up through that period, all the way through the 50s, it was, you know, the top seller for a number of record companies. So I would say that music associated with surfing, in that it was Hawaiian and there were some songs about surfing, were popular, and that popularization in some ways preceded the popularization of surfing in the U.S.
Okay.
And there's song collections of Hapu Hale. Now, a lot of them had things about surfing in it. There's one of the books I analyzed had a whole page that was from the tourist industry of Waikiki. And they're basically saying you can surf. You know, you can learn to surf. Here are the steps you can do. And yeah, it's really pretty interesting. Duke Hanamoku was featured in at least one of those. The songs, some of them weren't that many that reference surfing specifically, but a lot of the ones that do reference women surfing, which I love because it reminds us that women's were, you know, sometimes considered the best, or often considered the best surfers in Hawaii. That's on the mainland that really lagged here. But there was another side to it. I think the women were considered one of the attractions for white men to invest or come as a tourist to Hawaii. You know, there's also a lot of suggestion about availability of Native women, which I think was a fantasy for imperial, developed for imperial reasons. This is when Hawaii was a territory. You know, the queen Liliuokalani was deposed in the 1890s illegally. There's no question it was an illegal deposition of a sovereign, the leader of a sovereign nation. But Pearl Harbor was too valuable of an asset. It became a territory. And this is during this period that there's ways of promoting Hawaii for imperial reasons that tended to be have a racial message in that as well.
Yeah.
So that the music was there. I mean, that's part of the sound of Hawaii. It's the surfers in San Onofre that I interviewed, to the older surfers, they have ukulele groups, and they some of them would learn Hawaiian songs.
That's awesome. You know, I guess my question is, well, then, you know, what happened? And I know that, you know, in and around, and again, this is more your world than mine, but say the 50s, the electric guitar comes around, right? And so, and then you have some of these bands you've already mentioned, the Beach Boys, Dick Dale and his Deltones, you know, they kind of break out on the scene and become, you know, kind of coming back to our theme, they become surf music, as you put it.
Yeah.
So did they draw inspiration? Because it just seems to me like, you know, you're explaining this one type of music, and then there's sort of this beachy surf connection by using the ukulele and having these ukulele groups, which again, beautiful instrument. And, you know, the music you're talking about is absolutely beautiful. But then there's, let's say, the Beach Boys, right? There's Surf in USA. There's, you know, all of these sounds that come around that are very, you know, say, heavy in the electric guitar and all that. So, but do you, as an ethnomusicologist or as somebody who studies music, do you see the transition or the evolution, or do you see it more of almost a break from that tradition and a complete shift in another direction?
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a break. I see it's a re-expression for other purposes. Ruby Garofalo, who's a popular music scholar and has a textbook that's widely used in university called Rockin' Out, he talks about the surf music of the 60s as being an anthem to commodification in Southern California. You know, so in these 45 era, where you had one up to 4 minute song on one side, and you have a second song on the B side, so the A and B side, the A side would be a surf song, and the B side would be a hot rod song. You know, so the Beach Boys, this is how they did their 45s, surf and hot rod. And I think the Jan and Dean did the same sort of thing. So it's both, you know, it's very kind of California, Southern California culture being made there. go to the beach. Well, you gotta have a car to do that. So that there's ukulele tradition. I mean, they went parallel. I mean, there were then, there still are ukulele bands at San Onofre. There's a ukulele band plays here at the harbor in Santa Barbara every, you know, once a week. And there's lots of these bands. There's hula clubs that are very you know, powerful in California and around the world. You know, so there's a great ukulele orchestra that's based in London. You know, that's part of the scene. And it was associated, I think, through the first half of the 20th century, it was very much associated with surfing. The desire to go to Hawaii was one of the, you know, we all still like that idea. The Dick Dales and the Beach Boys, when they're basically using styles of music that were, you know, kind of hip at the time. I like the instrumental rock part of it for some reasons, as far as surfing, because it leaves it a little more open to the listener, right? You know, a text gives language to a song, whereas you know, instrumental rock leaves a little imagination. So, you know, songs like Pipeline, which has that famous that kind of descending thing, was, you know, started out as being about a gun or something like that, but then it was rebranded as a surfing thing, and it's worked for me, right? You know, that sound works. You know, if I can ever get in and out of a tube, it sort of sounds like that. There's that very nice sonic quality of surfing that captures, and the drippy reverb. Now, these are all, that's almost an accident. The reverb, the Fender outboard reverb, was developed for Dick Dale's voice because he didn't have a very good voice. And Dick Dale wanted to be Hank Williams, right? Being an instrumental guitarist wasn't his thing. He wanted to be the singer. But his voice wasn't that great. They developed the reverb for that, you know, and playing the guitar through it came later. This is what I was reading in the, you know, the historians of surf guitar. Seems to be what happened, which I love. And, you know, this is in Southern California. The Fenders, that's where Fender guitars were, and some of them still are made, you know. So he was working directly with the developer. So that sound is related to that scene. You know, to the extent it's related to surfing, Paul Johnson of the Bel Airs, who was not a surfer himself, is very generous with his time, talked to me about that. You know, he was a teenager when the Bel Airs had their Mr. Moto and other big hits. He says that surfers took the music and said, that's surf music. And that seems to be true. I think Dick Dale said similar things, and Dick Dale ran with it and, you know, played about surfing, and he surfed a bit himself. So, you know, I think that's a kind of a solid connection that's significant.
Yeah, no doubt about it. You know,
but I think I don't think it's unrelated to Hawaiian sounds. Guitars and guitar band, they were big in Hawaii. The Sons of Hawaii were more of an acoustic, but, you know, string band based group, which is very important in the Hawaiian Renaissance, especially in the 70s, for reviving Hawaiian language songs to help revive the language. You know, so that, so, and that's, I see some relations there to, you know, what's happening in California. But they're different scenes, different motivations.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, and you know, this is why I bring you on, to help make sense of all this, you know. And I guess in a you know, in a sense, there's really what's taking place, say, and while they are undoubtedly connected, you know, Scott Latterman and many others make those connections for sure. And Empire and Waves is just an incredible book. But, you know, both are affected, you know, this is the historian in me now talking, in their own, because of their own historical conditions. And so what's taking place in Southern California at the time is slightly different than, say, what's taking place in Hawaii at the time. And they're evolving in their own ways. But I think, you know, I'm really glad you helped sort of draw somewhat of a through line between that traditional ukulele sound and some of the other sounds, even into the 60s. And you know, unless I misunderstood you, but, you know, it seems to me there's more of a connection, let's say, than at least I initially thought.
Yeah, I think there is a connection. And even with the sound of the electric guitar, I mean, the first prototype electric guitars are made for Hawaiian players. I think Rickenbacker made like a lap steel thing that was electrified in the 40s or 50s. These are before Fender. So even that sound was partially developed in Hawaii. I mean, this is, and you know, a lot of the Hawaiian sound was being done here in California, in Southern California. There was a large influx of Hawaiians who moved to, especially Southern California, and hold neighbors in like Gardenia in the LA area were heavily Hawaiian, still are to some extent. And there's a big music scene, some of the best, most recorded Hawaiian artists did most of their work here in Southern California. So the sound was very much, they were influencing one another.
Yeah, no, that's, it's, you know, it's really just kind of a beautiful connection. And, you know, I really, like I said, I appreciate you, you know, sort of helping me make sense of it. Maybe some of the listeners as well. You know,
I'm sorry to interrupt. It's just,
no, you're good. Go
I'm
ahead.
I'm so excited about it. I mean, even some of the mid, the 20s and 30s, kind of country bands had ukuleles or were Hawaiian bands. And you know, there were Hawaiian bands are in that kind of string band, which now we call country and Western music, were Hawaiian bands. There are, you know, a number of Hawaiian bands, which I found to be fascinating.
Yeah. That's, you know, again, as, you know, an ethnomusicologist, you know, dare I say a music historian as well, you know, because that's really what you're doing. You're doing the work of a historian. And, you know, I really appreciate what you've written and, you know, and just making those connections. And for as much as I love music and just for the record, I saw, I think it was last, you know, about a year ago, I did see the Beach Boys at the Greek Theater in LA, you know, so for as much as I know I was calling, you know, I used the word kook earlier, but that was what, you know, some of the more hardcore surfers of the time said. But, you know, I being much younger than they are, I enjoy that music. And I maybe fell into that, as you called it, surf music. I mean, as I grew up as a kid, when I thought of the Beach Boys or, you know, Dick Dale, I'm like, that's surf music, or Wipeout, you know? And so, you know, that for me, if I were to make a soundtrack, and this is my segue to surf movies, by the way, if I were to make a soundtrack, you know, those are going on the soundtrack. And so, having said that, I do believe it's chapter 3 of your book. And again, correct me if I'm wrong, you start talking about surf movies and, you know, notable surf movies and their soundtracks. Now, I just want to read a quote real quick and then get your thoughts on it. But you say, you know, a surf movie is a silent movie to which the filmmaker adds sound. And that sound always includes music, lots of music, occasionally only music. Without it, even the diehard surfer would find a feature-length compilation of surfing footage tedious. And, you know, I do want to get your thoughts on it. And it made me think, you know, as I watched, you know, surf movies, Taylor Steele and others back, you know, back when I was a kid in the 90s, if there were no music to it, I don't know how long I'd be able to sit and watch these guys just surf in silence. So, you know, what were you thinking as you were writing that? And what, you know, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, thanks for that. Great question. I mean, how much time do you have? This is one of the, this is very helpful to look at surf films across time to make this connection, because it was a, you know, at some point somebody made a connection to certain music to footage of surfing, right? So that's what a surf film is. Most of the early ones, they started in the 50s with the Browns, Bruce Brown, and
I think John Severson was also making.
And there's another Brown. I'm completely embarrassed. I can't remember the other Brown's first name. Bud Brown, I think.
Bud Brown. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, and thank you. They're making films in the 50s. Bruce, and they were mixtape films. Now, these are low budget things played by the often by the filmmaker at the high school or junior high. Assembly hall, and they weren't licensed music, right? So there was, but you don't have that much knowledge about most of the films, except for Bruce was different in that he started getting people to make soundtracks with his first published film. I think that was a Slippery When Wet, and he hired, he says he happened to. There's a band called Bud Shank, and his band was playing at the Malibu Pier or something, and he just asked them, "Hey, would you play a soundtrack for this surf film I made?" So I've never done a soundtrack, and so I've never done a surf film before either. It's this beautiful kind of West Coast cool jazz sound that. Listening and reading and about what surfers were say about these things, who were surfers back then, and the early surfers, when there was a critical mass in the 50s, was whatever we want, but it was often like cool jazz, because that was kind of hip music. And I think there's a Barefoot Adventure is another one, but Bruce Brown did use Bud Shank, and I think those are really nice films. And his big breakthrough, and West Coast jazz is a particular sound, it's a particular genre of sound. It's might be considered white, that a lot of the players were white. It was different from the bebop sound out of the East Coast and Chicago's, from the New York and Chicago sounds. So quite a different sound. So that's, that plays into what's happening, who's owning surf in a sense, in the 50s, when you say surfer in certain, some contexts, the surfer would be a tanned white person. The Beach Boys even sing about that. Bushy blonde heritage. There's this whole, right, getting off the track there. So that's Bruce Brown was very nice that he we can attach specifically the music he put with it, and that's pretty rare. His big breakout film was Endless Summer. He commissioned the Sandells for that, which was a local band, including the Joris Brothers, who were immigrants from Belgium, with their parents who came looking for their sister, who had married a GI and lived here in California. And it's a wonderful story. They're in high school band, and Bruce Brown heard them at a party and asked them if they would do this next film, and it's just brilliant. So it's kind of surfy, right? If you listen to the Endless Summer soundtrack, there's a lot of instrumental rock. I don't know if they do any. Don't remember if they do any vocals in there. So you have, the music unhindered by your imagination, not hindered by language that specifies it as something. else. It's Snow Rock, but it's not like heavy Dick Dale, driving guitar stuff. It's a much more subtle thing going on.
Absolutely. I mean, sorry to interject. I'm just thinking of some of the music in the original Endless Summer. You could probably pick a song and play it for somebody who's, in their 40s, 50s, 60s, maybe even a little, that sort of that era, let's say. And they'd say, that's the Endless Summer, that soundtrack that movie obviously is, a seminal movie, but, how surf, it helped sort of diffuse surfing or helped in the popularization of surfing, surf travel, I would say. But it's that soundtrack too, that's so, you can't have one without the other almost. They just feel that tight. And so that for me, when I think of these, some of these soundtracks that go with, surf movies, whether it's The Endless Summer, the movie North Shore, from 1987, I believe, and even some of the more modern surf films, and Endless Summer 2, of course, in the 90s. But they really it's almost like you can't, they become so interwoven that they're hard to pull apart.
Yeah, it'd be a shame to pull them apart. They are beautiful capsules of style of that era. And of course, Endless Summer is also, again, it goes right back to your really nice work in Nicaragua, where it's about soft diplomacy. I mean, Endless Summer is, the Department of Defense could have funded that, right? They're going all of these nations around the world, and this premise that all surfers think is a little wacky, the best surf's not in the summer, but we'll look for Endless Summers. And they, there's encounters with exotic peoples around the world. So, this is, and some of those places have become surf destinations, right? Some of the Southern California spots in particular, or Southern African spots, becomes, almost ruined by surf destination. And they were kind of revealed in Bruce Brown's beautiful film, which has a narrative, so it's I really think the sandals, they got the music just right, and it had some surface and some not surface in it. It was a good mix. My favorite film is George Greeno's Innermost Limits of Pure Fun. Another pickup band of local people here in Santa Barbara called The Farm, included Dennis Dragon and others, who shows up later in the Surf Punks, right? An acoustic, mostly totally instrumental, a little bit of vocals, very little vocals, done to this film, which has no narration. It's just filmic image and music. 1969, right? At the kind of transition period into shorter boards. And it's a lovely film. The music, gosh, it just really, and he later did a piece with, 2 years later, 73, Crystal Boyer. Voyager with Pink Floyd's Echoes, so he got permission to use that. I think the deal was Pink Floyd said, yeah, you can use the music if we can use your film clips, and they, in some of their concerts, which is, pretty nice.
Absolutely.
That's another kind of beautiful pairing of, so that's a very psychedelic kind of shot, right? And that's a psychedelic era now we have short board surfing, but also more, Greeno's stunning shots, film of looking back into the tube while he's riding his very specially designed, that he designed, kneeboard with the camera strapped on his back, pointing backwards with a strobe or a light on it, filming these shots are
it was revolutionary at the time. Maybe not revolutionary, but definitely creative. Let's put it that way.
I think it was revolutionary, just technologically.
Yeah. And, you know, and it's funny to sort of connect, you know, Greeno and your, you know, the sort of your world and my world, let's say. I was reading a magazine about, as I was doing my work on Nicaragua, and there was one mention of Greeno surfing in southern Nicaragua. I didn't find much evidence beyond that, but I thought I'd throw that in there to sort of, you know, connect your, you know, what you're saying about his filmmaking and Pink Floyd and, you know, the music and all of that. And so, you know, our, all of our worlds, as you, you know, you mentioned a number of other amazing scholars, all of our worlds are so academically interwoven, you know, and I think that's really just a beautiful thing. But, you know, and I, the one, as you're talking and you, you know, you're mentioning these artists and you were talking about jazz and you're talking about, you know, later Pink Floyd and how it's all, you know, it sort of represents maybe a time period, but also surf movies and certain eras. You know, I'm thinking about how it evolved alongside surfboard technology, right? Because in the Endless Summer, they're longboards, you know, and they're on cruisy Malibu waves for the most part. And then we move into these surf films. I mentioned Taylor Steele, you know, the Momentum Generation. We've talked about that yeah. before, you and I. And all of a sudden you have, you know, actually, you know, I mentioned The Cure, Boys Don't Cry, I think was on one of the videos, but you get punk rock, you get, you know, some of these, some thrash metal, you get this more guitar driven, more heavier, faster. And it really complements that evolved or newer surf style. And, you know, that's probably for, you know, an episode in and of itself. Yeah, Tim, I know, you know, that's not necessarily part of, you know, the book per se, but, you know, what are your thoughts on, you know, sort of that marriage, if you will, of, you know, some of the punk rock genres, you know, even some of the grunge or alternative genres with the more modern surf style? You know, do you have any thoughts on that?
Looks like you need a vacation. Enter the 5-Hour Energy Where Will the Tide Take You sweepstakes. You could win a $10,000 dream beach vacation. Imagine jet setting off to a tropical paradise, having fun in the sun, or diving at a gorgeous reef. It's up to you. No purchase necessary. Go to 5hetide.com for official rules and to enter. That's 5hetide.com. Enter today. Ends June 30th, 2024.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile. And the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time. There's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yeah, I think they're intimately connected. I think, you know, the Taylor Steele films make this connection, and it captures a, you know, an extended cultural period through the 90s and into the early 21st century. You know, I think they're all just spot on. And some of the shots of this first Momentum of the young Kelly Slater with Bad Religion playing in the background, and Sprung Monkey. You know, this is that's good. And that's good watching as a surfer. That's really exciting to look at. And as an older surfer, it kind of helps me understand some of the style of some of the, you know, the top professional surfers. It also came into my interviews with musician surfers of. One particular note would be Jack Johnson, who, when I talked to him about, you know, he's generous enough to give me time to do a bit of an oral history about his relationships, connection between music and surfing in his life. And he talks about growing up on the South Shore in Hawaii, on Oahu, and how when he was an adolescent and a young teenager, and he, to get stoked up for surfing, he would listen to punk music or have punk music going on in his head. You know, this is a really important part of his being a surfer and surfing. You know, his music, he was wrapped up in it, and he was trying to, you know, play music like that as well. Of course, he's also playing kind of mellow music with the Hawaiian scene, with Hawaiians and others who were, you know, acoustic guitar and ukulele. So, you know, he's also, his parents were in that, and he's deeply invested in that. But he said, but he contrasted that with the feeling that he needs when you're on a big wave and looking at a big tube, right? You know, and that, he said, it's a different music. You know, it has to be slower music. You need, your heart rate needs to go down. And I found that really fascinating. So it's kind of the contest surfing music that he conceived of, and then more of a, you know, a slow, calm, and you got to relax into the wave of consequence feeling. So that was a beautiful example. There's also a guy named Mike Cava, and who played with one of the, who played at the Elks Club there in Waikiki with Eddie Kamai, who was one of the Sons of Hawaii. So this group that was very important in the Hawaiian Renaissance in the 70s forwards. And this guy's still playing, and he played with him there. And he was he and his partner were both major body surfers as well as stand-up surfers. And he also talked beautifully about their own songs, about, you know, wave riding and the rhythm of the ocean. So there's that aspect we haven't gotten into, is the and Sonny Bonono, who's a ukulele player and seller on the island of Kauai, just beautiful instruments, and a major surfer. And he I quote him in my book saying something along the lines of, surfing and music are the same thing. They're both playing with rhythm and time. And he's absolutely right. You know, waves move through water with the fundamentally same principle, physics principles, that sound moves through space. They bend around, sound and waves bend around objects in the same way. Light waves act in fundamentally the same way as well. So he's making a profound truth there. Sound waves and ocean waves, they're both about time. They're about rhythm. And that, I think that's, you know, sometimes gets pushed aside in some of the punk and grunge music, or maybe it's a really important part of it. But it's, you know, it's one way of being a surfer and thinking, yeah, about surfing.
Maybe the grunge and punk, that some of that choppy guitar is like, you know, a swell with a small period, like a small period swell versus, you know, some of the, you know, I'll use Jack Johnson, some of the smoother, or that, you know, some of the artists that you mentioned playing ukulele, that might be a long period swell, and you know, the surfers listening are, I don't know if they agree with that, but, you know, they certainly know what a short and long period swell are. Yeah. And that's, you know, that's profound. It's beautiful. And it's, you know, what's kind of interesting is, you know, throughout this podcast season, we've made a lot of references to whether it's philosophy and swell or music and swell, and the waves, the ocean, do provide the perfect analogy for that. And I, you know, in my episode, I talk about surfing as art, and what all of us individually do on waves is, in my view, at least, a form of art. Like, you are painting the canvas of the wave, let's say, to your, however you, you know, to your liking, let's say. But I'm glad we kind of ventured into the punk and grunge era of surfing and surf films, for sure. That's my era, so I'm certainly biased. And you know, I love, it's nice to know Jack Johnson, who of course, as you know, is a UCSB grad, but you know, it's nice to know he gets amped up by punk music as well. And just, you know, a funny story. I was recently surfing in El Salvador, and a buddy walked into the room. I was getting ready, and I can't remember if it was Pennywise's Unknown Road, which is, you know, early 90s, or The Offspring's, it was either Ignition or Smash. By the way, all three insanely amazing albums. But I had that like full blast on my speaker, and he walks in, he's like, "Man, you're getting pumped up, huh?" And I was like, "Oh man, dude, this is my surf music. You know, this gets me ready to paddle out." So I think you nailed it. I think, you know, it's nice to know Jack Johnson feels the same way. But and I guess, you know, to sort of pick your brain a bit more, this evolution of surfing, right? And how it was perfectly paired with this music. So that fast, racy surfing of the 90s, you know, thanks to the, you know, strides made in board technology, accompanied the sound. And so what are your thoughts on that? I know I kind of already asked, but is there anything else you want to add to that?
The sound helps us experience the surfing. You know, it helps us feel maybe something of what it likes to, you know, make that really quick off the lip and land it. Yeah, you mentioned the evolution of surfing, which I have some questions about that. And part of it comes from John Clark's Hawaiian Surfing book. So it's pulling together a lot of historical and current research on Hawaiian surfing. And he's making the argument that all the basic surf moves already existed, especially with the Aalia boards, the short boards that, you know, it's been wonderful. We've had surfers showing us what can actually be done on those boards and how hard they can turn and how you can, you know, cut across a wave and you can do a cut back. You can get in a tube and maybe even out of it, you know, so, which is always fun to be the trick is getting out of the things. He's suggesting that, you know, the kind of reinvention, what I call in my book, new surfing, reinvention of surfing in the mid 20th century, kind of appropriating Hawaiian things in different ways. We might be overemphasizing innovations in technology that aren't as significant, that are overlooking the quality of surfing that existed before contact in Hawaii. You know, surfing was somewhat suppressed, you know, actively or by suggestion when Hawaii was missionized. There's a wonderful book by James Revel Carr, Hawaiian Music in Motion, which is about really the music that happened on the ships coming between North America, often the East Coast, Boston, and to Hawaii and back in the 18th and 19th century up to the 20s. And he documents the rich variety and the exchange of ideas about music at that time, primarily with the nobility, which was understood to be the, you know, the rulers of a legitimate, you know, kingdom.
What's interesting, Tim, is how, you know, you're using, you know, again, it's a music history approach, you know, looking at history through this lens, which is, you know, incredible. To your point about the Calvinist missionaries and their impact on surfing, you know, Isaiah Walker's Waves of Resistance is an incredible book on, you know, the history of Hawaii, the history of surfing in Hawaii, the rise of Dahui. Absolutely. And, I want to bring you back to your something you say in your book, just to kind of get your thoughts. And I'm curious to know what your favorite genre is among all these genres we've been talking about. But in your book, you say that, you know, there's also professional musicians of all sorts who are passionate about and draw inspiration from surfing, including popular musicians, and, you know, many of our listeners will recognize these names: Eddie Vedder, Jackson Brown, Tristan Pettyman, Ben Harper, Chris Isaak, Brandon Boyd of Incubus, of course. And, you know, you even include Metallica's Kurt Hammett and Robert Trujillo. And so, you know, again, these are individuals that, you know, very popular and incredibly talented musicians that have drawn a lot of inspiration from surfing. But, you know, so my question to you is, you've talked about a whole host of artists through the decades, but do you have a favorite genre yourself?
I don't. I anticipated this question, but I can't come down on a genre that I most associate with surfing, especially after, you know, doing this research. It just really blew open my mind about what surfing can be. No, maybe that was a little disingenuous. I do really like the Farms music that was done for Greenos and Almost Limits for Pure Fun. That fits with my era of 70s, you know, when I was coming of age, 70s surfing really well, which is kind of a mellow cutback style surfing. and I think it, you know, like it did with Jack Johnson, I think it changes a lot of people. You know, Tom Curran was another local guy here, and incredibly influential surfer as well as kind of artist and musician. And he was, when he was, you know, younger and really pushing quite successfully in the professional surfing scene, he was playing sort of hard jazz and moving into punky type stuff, you know, really quite edgy music. Now in his later years, though, during this period, he still continued to perform, to surf competitively. He's moved into, you know, a little bit easier, slightly more acoustic guitar sounds, but also a lot of electric stuff. You know, so he's sort of mellowed a bit in that sense, even though he's still the most progressive surfer out there in many settings. You know, like, went to one of the Rincon Classics, and he wasn't competing, but it was a big wave day at Rincon, and he's, you know, this guy just rips a wave, you know, just between contest sets, and he comes in, and it's Tom Curran with this teeny short board with these two jaggedy, experimental fins. You know, one of the most kind of pleasant insertions into what was a longboard session, where they see him rip through on these waves. I'm not going to be able to satisfy you with my favorite genre of music. I must say, one of the things this book has encouraged me to do is to listen to surfing, so, and to pay attention to the sounds of surfing. And I got some of this from the early 60s surfers. Like, there's one guy, his name is Pitt, who lives up in Santa Cruz, who had a surf band, and he was 12 in 1961. So he was into the instrumental rock, and he was the right age, and he's still doing it. And in a really kind of punky way, actually. He had a really edgy surf band that was really on the edge of punk. And, but he said, yeah, you know, the reverberation, you know, that resonates with me as a surfer, and the underwater sounds and the pipes. And he was an active surfer, even though he's quite senior. But where was, oh yeah, so he was talking the sounds of surfing itself, and that's something that's inspired me a lot. It's just listening to the change of the sound of your board through the water when you go over the shoulder and you're kicking out, and maybe right over the shoulder at Rincon again. I remember having these some good exonic experiences there with this very distinct sounds. I just love that. And that, you know, that sound I find very inspiring. You know, surfing and playing with those ocean waves, experiencing them also as sound waves, is a way of immersing yourself in the ecosystem. Perhaps, you know, when the two dolphins come and they show you where the set wave is, because they poke their head through it saying this one. And then you get, you know, that's a type of communication with this wonderful zone where ocean waves meet the land and transfer their energy. And maybe they let you use a little bit of it to a play with surfing. And I think that's, listening to that is something I've gotten more into. And I've even tried to get some of my surfing students to record their surfing for me. Had a surfer who was a guy who was doing some work with me as a student assistant, doing some filming for me. And I got him to record some tubes up at Hollister Ranch.
Sorry to bust in and interrupt you. I think, is this something because I think you and I have talked about before, and yes, by the way, listening to nature, listening to the sounds of waves is relaxing too. It's just immersing yourself in all of that energy, let's say. Is this something you call, I know something you work on, as you said, do you call it eco-musicology? Did I get that right?
Yeah. I mean, eco-musicology is a kind of a subfield of musicology that's trying to better understand music as interacting with ecologies, with other biological living beings, whether that be the ocean itself, wind patterns, tide patterns, sea mammals, land mammals. And so this is part of the work I'm doing up back in the Tatra Mountains, where I've also written about, where there's delicate mountain ecosystems in Central Europe that are experiencing a lot of change, primarily because of economic pressure and population pressure is due to tourism, the promotion of, and then the way some tourism is put in place. This is related to the way I'm thinking about surfing now, is that I'm trying to listen to non-human, sometimes we say more than human sounds. What are the birds telling me? What are the coyotes telling me about what's going on at night? What are the seagulls? And I never heard the other birds talk that much, but the seagulls talk a lot, right? And the tern. A few months ago, my wife and I went out in kayaks for us, a full moon rise out of the harbor. And it was pretty dark, except for the moon. And we kept hearing, one trip out, we kept hearing these flocks of hundreds of terns fly over, and they're this chirp, chirp, chirp they were making. And another one, we kept hearing the splashing, it was getting closer and closer. And there were just many pods of dolphins that came through our area, and how beautiful that was, and how what it kind of informs us, reminds us of where we were floating and bobbing around.
That sounds, so peaceful, and just, sounds like an awesome experience. And, it's really cool how you just constantly tie your work back into surfing, as, many of us do. And certainly, the individuals I've brought on the podcast. But Tim, this has just been an absolute pleasure. Digging into music and its relationship to surfing. Like I said, I was, really looking forward to this. And, I want to go ahead and give you the last word.
Hey, thank you, Dr. Old. This is, really an honor to be invited to be on this podcast, which has, you've already had many of my favorite scholars from whom I've, learned so much. What I like about your work and some of the other people that you've interviewed is that they're reminding us that surfing does have impact. We have to be gentle with the ecologies we're surfing in, but also the cultures we're surfing in, and music is a really big part of that. There is an imperial quality to surfing, as Scott Latterman has pointed out so well, so convincingly, that we need to be aware of. But I also, that's why I like focusing on the feelings and the sounds and all those things that are good. And I wrote that bit that you'd asked about earlier about the riding a wave leaves no trace, music leaves no trace, in an acoustic sense. you know, they disappear. Once you kick out of the wave, the wave, that ride is only memory. You have transferred some energy into the water, just like any vibration, you've transferred energy. A song has transferred energy, but once you've heard it, it vanishes. And I think there's that temporality of that, and that transfer of energy is a really is more important to me than getting the best wave or having the, you know, the most hoots on a ride than anything else. It's that cooperation with this wonderful ocean, that or lake or other or river bore, whatever you're surfing at the moment.
If you enjoyed my conversation with Tim about his research on surf music, I'd like to invite you to check out my next episode, where I'll be joined by environmental scientist Ed Atkin. Ed and I will be chatting about his research on surf science and surfing resource management, as well as his involvement with the Aotearoa New Zealand Association for Surfing Research and the International Association of Surfing Researchers. If these topics pique your interest, then this will most certainly be an episode you won't want to miss. We also want to take a moment to thank Banana Bag Oral Solution again for sponsoring this episode. Don't forget to check them out at bananabag.org. And while you're there, use promo code STAYSTOKED for 10% off your purchase. Be sure to join their mailing list too if you want free shipping. Thanks for joining us for another episode of The Surfing Historian. If you're stoked on these conversations, be sure to share, like, and subscribe to never miss an episode. And don't forget to check out our killer merch at surfinghistorian.com. Proceeds go to help keep this amazing podcast going strong. Until next time, stay stoked.
For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.